US President Donald Trump will be arriving on Wednesday. And there's been a lot of hoo-ha about where he'll go and where the Taoiseach will meet him and all that. When I'm joined in studio by Miles Duncan, broadcaster and author and historian, on visits here from presidents and where Trump sits in the middle of all that.
Yeah, well, there have been quite a few of them. Official visits, visits made by presidents who were no longer in office. So before Kennedy arrived in 63, we had... You can go back to Ulysses Grant in 1879, who visited Ireland. Now, he was no longer president at that stage. Dwight D. Eisenhower visited in 1962 before Kennedy did, but he was no longer president either. So Kennedy was the first official visit, although it wasn't his first visit to Ireland either, because he had the family connections and he had been to the family home in Dungannstown in Wexford as a young senator in the 50s.
No connection, Dungannstown.
I hope there is, and I will diligently research it. You know, if anything comes up, I'll let you know.
That'd be very, very good. He was kind of like a rock star.
Total rock star. I was a nerdy 9-year-old in short pants, and an aunt and an uncle decided, they literally arrived at my house in Kells and said, we're bringing Miles up to see the press. And I was absolutely thrilled because I just thought this guy was absolutely amazing. And I don't know whether it was deliberate or what, but they positioned themselves and me in Cahill Brewer Street. So it was perfect because the motorcade had to turn the corner out of O'Connell Street into Cahill Brewer Street, and it slowed down and you got a good look at the two of them. And I still have that memory in my head of these two men standing, Dev and Kennedy standing, and they were clutching a stanchion on an open top car. I don't know what kind of car it was, and Kennedy was waving. Kennedy looked absolutely amazing. He had something that nobody, two things that nobody in Ireland had in those days. He had a suntan and he had teeth. He had white teeth. He had teeth that you didn't have to be ashamed to actually show to the world. Right. And he was amazing. And Dev was standing there, and Dev looked very, very old. And obviously in comparison to Kennedy, he would.
Yeah.
And he wasn't that old actually at the time. I suppose to a 9-year-old, he was ancient. But he seemed to me to be clutching the stanchion for grim death. And he certainly wasn't waving, but he was very erect and he was very straight and he was very soldierly, as Dev always was.
And then he addressed the Leinster House.
Yeah, he did.
As indeed did Nancy Pelosi last week.
Indeed.
I
hope she made fewer mistakes
Trump
than he did.
What were his mistakes?
Oh, I don't know who wrote the speech for him, but they made an absolute hames of it.
Bill Shannon.
Bill Shannon. Was it Bill Shannon? Oh my God. That's incredible, because Bill Shannon has written probably one of the best books on Irish American history. But in the first paragraph, he had the Battle of Fredericksburg in September. It was in December. In the second paragraph, he had Thomas Francis Marr leading the Irish Brigade into the Battle of Fredericksburg. He was sick that day, and he didn't. He took the day off, which was probably just as well, because most of them were killed. And then he makes this remark, which Dev did not go down well with, our Dev, because he was referring to Lord Edward Fitzgerald, his almost namesake, who had once written to his mother that Leinster House does not inspire the brightest ideas, because it was the family home, obviously, of the family. And Kennedy uses this line, and Dev apparently upbraided him afterwards.
Well, hello.
Did not like that joke.
Repeat it.
Leinster House does not inspire the brightest ideas. Now, don't tell me you're going to...
I think maybe...
Oh, no, I think he was perfectly in order, but Dev certainly didn't.
A thesis for somebody there.
There's a smidgen of a point.
Yeah. Dev said that he had done Irish politicians no service in cracking that particular joke. I think I gather around the table here that nobody would agree with Dev. We'd all be on John F. Kennedy's side.
Anyway, moving on. Then... Nixon came.
I remember. The one I don't remember is Bush. I mean, which is weird because it's far more recent. I do remember Nixon coming because he was very, very unpopular. It's not one we talk about because we don't like to acknowledge that the only American president who ever resigned actually had Irish antecedents. Now, they were pretty distant antecedents. Great, 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 great grandfather was Thomas Milhouse. So it was on his mother's side. His mother was Hannah Milhouse. So he arrived and went to visit the Quaker graveyard where his great grandfather was buried. That was in Timahoe in Kildare. He visited that, and he was here for 3 days, and there were anti-Vietnam War protests, and his motorcade was successfully egged by our Maureen de Burka, who seems to have been a pretty good shot, because she got the windscreen. For the record, if anyone is interested in the technical details, it was an overarm lob, and she hit the windscreen, and she told the Examiner in 2010, "I was so proud of myself. Then I was grabbed by a guard and hauled across the bridge."
Not for the first time.
With a clatter of old women shouting, "Throw her in the river! Throw her in the river!"
Were you involved in any of the...
I was involved, believe it or not, as far back as John F. Kennedy's visit.
Oh, were you?
I had two roles. I was the third secretary in the Department of Foreign Affairs. I was helping to organise the crowds at Áras an Uachtaráin, and the crowds completely overwhelmed us, and it was completely chaotic, with all the county councillors in particular who had been invited for the occasion very anxious to touch the president. And it was like a scrum the likes of which you have never seen.
And how did you unscramble the scrum?
There was nothing we could do. We adjourned to one of the side rooms and had a drink. Let them get on with
isn't
it.
Isn't it great, though, they didn't take that stuff? Because it could have been the end of his career. Where would he have been?
And then I remember, some of you will remember, a great former colleague of mine, now deceased, Con Howard. Howard organised the press from the Gresham Hotel. And for the duration of the visit, we could go in and out to the Gresham Hotel and get free food and free drink.
These are where organisational details matter. You drive our listeners. Were you involved in any of
I was involved in the Obama visit, which followed immediately after the Queen's visit. And as a result, we had 2,200 journalists accredited from across the world. The Queen is very big in Japan, apparently, because two or three networks even came from Japan for that. But they then stayed on for the Obama
visit.
Yeah,
the press office was in the Mahon Tribunal.
That's right. Not, the press centre.
Yeah, the press centre.
And we had to feed them on the state's expense, I remember, because it was one of the first queries we got after the president left. And he was a great visit. He arrived early and left early because, if you remember, the ash cloud
came, so
he was the perfect guest. He just left the night before he was supposed to go. But anyway, the first query we got into the government press office at the time, how much did we spend on entertaining the media? It came from, or looking after them, it came from one paper itself. So they asked, how much did you spend on feeding us? It was well over, around 60,000, I remember. They had to be fed for a whole week.
All right. How many of them? 2,000?
2,000, yeah.
For 60,000 for a whole week.
Yeah.
Is that good value?
Sounds pretty good.
Anyway, I didn't know there was free grub for journalists.
We had to be incredible. You just couldn't rock up, Marion.
The early visit.
I remember. Yeah.
I hope you have it in your book, The Early Visit of Woodrow Wilson. Do you have that one in your book?
Sorry, Sean, you have me. Stumped me there.
Yeah, Woodrow Wilson came. He spent 3 or 4 days. He wrote a letter, which is now available. He wrote a letter home to his wife saying, "Dublin is distinctly unimpressive. I should have gone to Antwerp." He spent 3 days.
When was that?
That was before he became president, so it must have been in the
1900s. He was the president of Princeton, I think.
He was president of Princeton at the time. And he couldn't get decent accommodation because everything was booked out for the Dublin Horse Show.
And you know what? This is probably why he refused to see the Irish delegation that went to the Treaty of Versailles.
It had a huge impact on him when he became president.
Yeah, but then there was payback a few years later when the Irish Americans galvanised opposition to the Treaty of Versailles and his League of Nations. So, you know, what goes around comes around.
Yeah. Okay, now we have... Which one do you want to do next?
Well, I suppose Reagan was next, wasn't he? In 1984, Michael D. boycotted, but that was before the presidency was even a gleam in his eye, one assumes, unless he was very ambitious even at that stage. And Reagan came, obviously, as we all know, to visit the village of Ballyporeen, where his great-grandfather, an interesting interestingly, if you look at the degrees of separation, yeah. Nixon was many, many, many degrees separated. Obama was three greats, great, great, great grandfather, but Reagan was only great grandfather. Michael Regan, and they changed the spelling of the name later, who emigrated to England in 1851 and then to the USA in 1857. And of course, he visited John O'Farrell's pub, which became the Ronald Reagan pub, which closed down in 2005. And they took the facade of the pub, and it now apparently stands in the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library in California. So they obviously took it seriously. And obviously a lot of dissent there as well, because we were in the middle of the Nicaraguan, the Sandinistas and the Contras and that contretemps. But there was a lot of support in Ireland for the Sandinistas, and the protesters were kept at a safe distance.
Was that the one where the Irish passport was used?
Yeah, this not at that stage. Now, at what point they were, I don't know, but certainly about a year later it emerged, and this may have come from Reagan really loving his visit to Ireland, because his national security advisor, Robert McFarlane, who I think had probably resigned at that stage and was working on other things, and Colonel Oliver North, who made a reputation for himself, they both travelled to Iran, and it was a very dodgy arms deal involving Israel, and it was a way of getting money to the Contras, which the Congress did not allow, and they were carrying Irish passports, and obviously he was so enamoured of our green and pleasant land that he'd recommended that they use Irish travel documentation in the process.
Is there anything a country like this can do about that? That was outrageous.
Well, very interestingly, in addition to the two Irish passports, they also painted an aircraft in the Aer Lingus colours.
Oh, that's right.
And sometime afterwards, the late Peter Barry, as Minister for Foreign Affairs, who had raised the matter with Secretary of State Schultz, got a profound apology from Schultz, who said not only did he know nothing about it, but he believed the President knew nothing about it.
Ooh, I'm not so sure about that.
Well, that's why I'm telling you.
Yeah.
He believed the President may have known nothing about it. I'm certain Schultz knew nothing about it.
No, Schultz didn't. In the flak that hit afterwards, Schultz wasn't involved in, but exactly. Reagan definitely was.
Oh, Reagan was.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
But if you are a tiny little country, very hard to assert your rights against the might of the United States doing something outrageous.
Yep.
You know?
I mean, all you can do is what Peter Barry did, seek and get a profound apology.
Right.
Not much good. But my main memory of the visit to Ballyporeen, obviously I was involved in all of it, was the local parish priest, supported by his Catholic bishop, decided that Reagan could not attend Mass because he was a divorced man.
Oh, dear.
Even though Reagan had asked one of his advisors, Mike Deaver, get a good present for the church in Ballyporeen, the Catholic church, which is where his great-grandfather had been baptised.
Mm.
So they went to Tiffany's in New York and they got a replica made of one of the well-known chalices in Ireland. I've forgotten which one. And it was presented to the parish priest, but there was no Mass.
Good Lord.
It was a service, but it was felt it would be inappropriate to have a Mass for him.
Because he was divorced.
Because he was divorced. I think that may have been one of the last hurrahs of the Catholic Church of
this
Ireland.
This was, 84, so absolutely.
Yeah, astonishing, isn't it? Yeah, when you think about it, I know hindsight, etc., 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 but not to say Mass because somebody was divorced, it seems extraordinary, doesn't it?
And I just remember the chalice they replicated.
It was the
Ardat chalice.
The Ardat chalice,
was it?
I was wondering.
Okay, now, moving swiftly on. We have to get up to Trump, you know, while we're still
on. Do we have to? All right, I suppose we have to. Well, Clinton. Clinton's visit was probably the most historically significant presidential visit. And I'm not just saying that because my great-grandmother was a Clinton and we might be related. He was the first sitting president to visit Northern Ireland. Grant had actually visited Northern Ireland, but he wasn't a president. And obviously in advance of coming here, had made a huge mark on the Northern Irish peace process, a real mark. And that's significant step in angering British diplomats, angering the British government, angering unionists by granting Gerry Adams a visa to the USA. But who knows, that could have been, and him and Sean would obviously know better than any of us, crucial.
Were you around when that was happening?
No, not that one.
And so that, you know, and then George Mitchell the same year was tapped as the lead negotiator in the ongoing peace process, and Clinton comes, and you know, there's an outpouring. This is the one interesting thing, or one of the many interestings. When a Democratic president arrives, by and large there are no protests. When a Republican president arrives, there always seem to be protests.
Well, I remember going to something in Trinity College, and Clinton was there. He was giving a speech. And I used to be a student once upon a time.
An architecture student, and a very good one, I believe.
Revolting students, you know, is what you were. And I remember seeing all these mounds of students in Trinity all wanting to touch him, shake hands with him, you know, and not an ounce.
You should see them when he comes to the Clinton Institute now. It's exactly the same.
But I mean, there was a lot about his foreign policy that was very dubious. And here were all these groupies.
But he got absolute rock star treatment in Northern Ireland and here, and he had incredible memories of it. And he was probably one of, if not the most successful and the most outstanding foreign policy achievement as American president, was the Northern Ireland peace process. And obviously he's been back many, many times.
It must break his heart what's going on now.
Oh, yeah.
Or what's not going on.
One would imagine so. But, I mean, that was, a hugely successful visit. And as I say, he's been back on many occasions, and he has an institute called after him across the road over in UCD. And, in fairness, he visits on a fairly regular basis. Makes talks.
I think he's made good friends here as well.
Very definitely.
So then...
the one we'd all forgotten, George Bush, 2004. Yeah. I'd completely forgotten that he ever came to Ireland. And he came to Drumoulin Castle and he met Bertie Ahern and he met President McAleese. But he was actually here for... he was here on official business. He was here on... it was the US-EU summit. And 7,000 security presence. Guardians, Gardaí, goons, bodyguards, spooks, who knows what. Now, they weren't all guarding W. But if you remember... from an RTE point of view, something we're all very proud of on this station. The most memorable thing, I think, about it took place shortly before, when then RTE Washington correspondent Carol Coleman showed the White House press corps how to do an interview with the president. And W had obviously been expecting a sort of an Aaron sweater, a cosy Aaron sweater type of interview, but he got a shillelagh interview from Carol, bless her, and her blood is worth bottling. And the interview led then to... there was supposed to be a cosy chat with Bush's wife Laura thereafter, which God knows Carol might have decided to let Laura off the hook and do a cosy chatter. It never took place because the interview was cancelled because of the mauling that he got from Carol.
I think that's very interesting. Is there a kind of a protocol whereby you're not allowed to ask supplementaries?
There is no protocol, but I think in America they don't tend to do it. It's amazing interviews that I've been involved with, three Taoiseach in America. When you're doing the interview, they ask a question, they don't listen to the answer, they move on to the second and the third question. So there's no supplementary to do, even if you dropped a huge clangor in the middle. Whereas the Irish or the English or the European journalists are listening to what you say, and if you misstep, you're going to get tackled.
But there is a White House tradition that before the president does a trip abroad, if there is a local Irish correspondent in Washington, he or she is invited in for a soft interview.
Is it described as such?
It is.
So what do you say? You're a wonderful...
well, you're supposed to ask questions about, and what is your connection? And what part of Ireland do you know? And did you ever talk to your granny about that sort of thing? Right. Not about policy. In fact, I think the interviewer is specifically instructed not to discuss policy.
Extraordinary, isn't it?
Carol will tell the story herself.
Yeah.
But I think she was remarkably brave, courageous, and she did a good journalistic job.
Brilliant job.
Rightly so. Yeah. That's extraordinary. Yeah. That could catch on here.
I don't think so. I think I'll just spoken that one.
Pardon?
Absolutely not. Not on my watch.
Now, we'll skip Obama because we have done him. We're coming up now to the man himself.
Oh, yes, the man himself. This would be President Trump, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're talking about soft interviews and with correspondents. Obviously, we're getting the fallout in Britain of the interviews that have been taking place between, I think it was the Sunday Times and The Sun, and President Trump and his full-hearted support for Boris Johnson and how Britain should leave the European Union with no deal on the 31st of October, etc., etc., etc.
Just a moment.
So, you know, soft interview. I mean, it's reciprocal.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're all very savvy people. Would you think that getting the support of Donald Trump in the current climate in Great Britain would be an advantage or a disadvantage?
I'm not sure, but I can precedent here. Do you remember Lisbon won, and Sarkozy came and insisted from the steps of government building that we should all support Lisbon won, and we didn't support Lisbon won because we felt, who does he think coming in here telling us what to do? So if you were to apply the same logic, it's not going to work well for Boris now. I'm not sure whether they will apply the same logic, but I think people sticking their nose into other people's business abroad, it doesn't go down well.
Suzanne?
I think it depends on how far Boris is ahead. Mm. In other words, I'm giving you an accountancy answer. In other words, if Boris is home and dry, it doesn't make one whit of difference. But if Boris is there, and it could influence him, obviously, but I think Boris might be ahead.
Yeah, his good friend, Mr. Bannon, I saw in the paper a couple of weeks ago, has bought up this amazing place somewhere in Italy to get all the dissidents within Europe to cooperate to break Europe apart.
So this is like a Salzburg seminar.alt or something like that, isn't it? Yeah, something along those lines.
Anyway, what's the story? Where is he going? What's he doing? How?
I don't know. I don't give a toss where he's going. You asked me to research previous presidents, presidential visits. I have zero interest in this one. My hope is, one thing we're great at in this country, as far as I'm concerned, is ignoring people. And I think we should ignore him, and I think that'll really, really, really be fed up if he's completely ignored. But there you go.
May I give you a dissenting voice from County Clare? In Doonbeg, he will be treated as a hero. Most villages in the west of Ireland are suffering hugely economically in the last 20 years. Young, bright people are gone off to Dublin, London, Australia, whatever. Doonbeg Trump Resort employs just over 300 people, led by a very good Irishman called Joe Russell. They have built up a huge little industry, keeping the village probably more alive than any village I know, certainly in County Clare. There are 5 pubs in Doonbeg, all doing well. Where I live in Killaloe, there are 2.5 pubs left. The others have all closed down. So he will be greeted very, very warmly. And already in Doonbeg, the flags have been up. Now, there's a jazz festival in Doonbeg this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Maybe that's why the flags are up. But if anybody tries to raise a voice, I mean, you can raise a voice in Doonbeg, but no. He will be warned.
I'm suggesting the opposite. I'm suggesting don't raise a voice. Just ignore him.
Yeah, well, he won't be ignored.
No. Well, the parish priest already in Doonbeg has already said that Trump is
divorced. He's divorced.
He is going to heaven, is he describing Trump. So whether Doonbeg is heaven or whether he's actually going to heaven, I'm not sure. But there's an article in today's, and there's lots of articles in the paper today, but the one that I latched onto was Doonbeg, a flutter over Trump's visit, and it's articulating exactly what John has just said.
Right.
It is very important commercially for them.
Right.
Yeah, there's also the aspect of our relationship, Ireland's relationship with America has always traditionally been very strong, very important politically. So the government obviously have to be seen to show up, show a certain amount of respect, abide by all the protocols, all that kind of stuff. And you know, I think they'll be hoping that it just goes off without any hitches. If it goes off without any hitches and the thing is short and sweet, they'll be happy that it's done. And
I do think the government has to show respect for the office.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. That's what I'm trying to say. Yes, exactly.
You want to come in there, Niamh?
Yeah, I think totally agreed. And there's a woman as well in the village in the same article, separate the man from the office is what she's saying, because she doesn't agree with his politics. And I think that's what's really important here, is that we do what, you know, we're good hosts. But the fact is that Trump's politics and the politics of Trump are completely at odds with everything that Trocar stands for. And I think everything that many Irish people stand for in terms of his policies that divide people, undermine peace and threaten the sustainability of the planet in terms of the action. actions he's taken at home. And I says, we'd encourage, you know, we need to meet and we greet. But I think Angela Merkel, you know, I think really showed the way for leaders in one of her first meetings with Trump in you know, holding true to her own values and making the points when meeting him. So, of course, we need to welcome
him. Not everyone is going to ignore him like Miles wanted. There's some TDs have, in one of the articles, said that they're going to protest. But what's bothering me is that, you know, this blimp, this Trump blimp has been bought over, and that's fine. No problem with that if you're going to fly it in County Clare where he is. But from listening to...
I understand that's going to do it in Dublin.
In Dublin, at the Garden of Remembrance.
The blimp?
It's an inflatable Trump.
It's the nappy. It's the big
but
Trump.
But if they were to do it from the Garden of Remembrance, if that report is accurate, I would be disappointed in that. I wouldn't think that is appropriate.
Right. It's a tricky one, this whole business. Of course, it is accepted that the Taoiseach, but I notice the President is not. Our President is not.
It's not a state visit.
Oh, that's only for...
It's not a state visit, it's not an official visit, it's not a working visit. Apparently it's a private visit. But these things have all become blurred in recent years, and we have to take some responsibility ourselves. Our presidents, the last three, for example, visited parts of the United Kingdom, including obviously Northern Ireland, but also Birmingham, Liverpool, with no formality.
Right.
Not state, not official, not working. They went on what were described as private visits. So I think, to be fair, in recent times, all that formality has been, at least at minimum, is diluted. And I think a president of the United States is perfectly entitled to come here. I think the Taoiseach was right not to go to the Doonbeg resort to meet him, though I think he should have gone to Morrissey's pub in Doonbeg to meet him. That's Irish soil, genuinely Irish, and we do have a tradition of bringing heads of state and government to pubs.
John, I thought we were getting out of that.
Not at all, no.
I thought we need
the promotion. But my biggest criticism of Trump, and I accept all the criticisms of his policy, but he's the first American president since 1790 not to appoint a representative in Dublin. In 1790, President George Washington, acting on the advice of his Secretary of State, Thomas Jefferson, appointed William Knox as his consul in Dublin. And every single president since has done the same thing.
Not in a mad rush. I mean, Obama.
Well, but he did it.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, President Trump has recently nominated, I think, a man called Crawford, who has been approved by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, but not yet approved by the Senate as a whole. I mean, the Trump first term will be over before the man arrives at the present rate. But I think that's a pity. And it shows, frankly, a lack of interest on the part of President Trump in Ireland.
Right. Well, there you go. I mean, none of us thought he might be more interested in us, though, because of our taxation and employment and all of those kind of things, because it could send a shiver of anxiety down one's spine. Listen, we're going to have to take a break and we'll come back and talk about D-Day. Before I leave the White House, Miles has written a book called The White House, which he describes as...
Yes, it's actually a set in a parallel universe, and it deals with an American president who owns a golf course in Ireland. The golf course is, however, on the east coast of Ireland, which means that it bears no relationship whatever to the current incumbent of the White House. And the problem is that one of his greens on his golf course is being inundated by the Irish Sea, and he wants Ireland to build a wall, and he wants the Irish to pay for it.
There you go.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go. Well, on that note now, we'll take a break.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.
Wondering if alcohol is affecting your health, weight or wallet? Find out using the drinks calculator at askaboutalcohol.ie from the HSE.
Introducing Toyota's new generation cars, including the all-new Corolla family and the iconic Camry, as well as Ireland's best-selling hybrid, the Toyota CHR. Powered by self-charging hybrid engines that are in electric mode over 50% of the time. Take advantage of great 192 offers at the new generation event, including trade-in boosters of up to €3,000. From June 5th to 8th at your Toyota dealer. Toyota. Built for a better world. Terms and conditions apply.
At Super Value, we love meat. And this week, our steak and wine sale is now on. Save 33% on fresh Irish strip loin, fillet and cowboy steak. Pair your steak with our specially sourced Italian wines. Buy any six bottles and save €10. Because if you want the best quality meat in Ireland, it's got to be Super Value. Enjoy alcohol sensibly.
This June in Home Store and More, all water fountains are half price. All lightweight duvets are half price. And all outdoor cushions are half price. That's right, half price. But better hurry, because when all the half-price water fountains are gone, they're gone. And when all the half-price lightweight duvets are gone, they're gone too. And as for all the half-price outdoor cushions, when all the half-price outdoor cushions are gone, they're definitely gone. All offers available online at homestoreandmore.ie, as well as in-store at Home Store and More. Home Store and More. Your home made more.
The Marion Finucan Show on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Tesco. Providing free delivery for everyone 65 or older when you shop online. Tesco. Every little helps.
Welcome back to the programme. Now, we are going to turn our attention to D-Day and the commemoration thereof. Miles, you had a look at the Irish connections at the event, essentially.
Mm. Well, I mean, the Irish... Yes, exactly. I mean, I did, a couple of thousand years ago, I did a documentary series called Distant Drums, which was 12 programmes on Irish veterans of foreign armies and foreign wars, and half of the programmes were about the Second World War, because I wanted to talk to as many of that cohort of people. It was in the 1990s. They were still alive. They were into their 70s. Still perfectly cogent, and I didn't want to miss them. And so one of the programmes was about D-Day, so I talked to a number of people who had been involved in D-Day, and some of them were quite surprising individuals who were involved in D-Day, either directly or indirectly.
Tell me more.
Well, Lord and Lady Callanan, for example.
Yeah.
I went to the house in Mount Pleasant and where they lived at the time, and talked to the two of them. Lord Callanan in particular, who was obviously, he was Michael Morris, he was 3rd Baron. At the time, his father had been the commander of the Irish Guards at the start of the First World War, was killed within a few days of the start of the First World War, so he never knew his father. But he still was part of that Anglo-Irish martial military tradition. So he was in the British Army. He was a staff officer with the 30th Armoured Brigade, and he was heavily involved in the preparation for D-Day, for Operation Overlord. Operation Overlord was the overall thing. Operation Neptune, excuse me, was the D-Day invasion. But I mean, one of the things he told me was a couple of weeks before, and there was supposed to be a ban. I mean, I read somewhere there was a ban on travel, and the, you know, leave was cancelled, etc. He told me a couple of weeks before the event, he hightailed it back over to Dublin and was wandering around Dublin, was swanning around Dublin, was having drinks or whatever. And had he said, had I been loyal or an alcoholic, I could have spilled the beans. I knew absolutely everything, except that there was going to be a postponement for 24 hours
because of the weather.
Now, I mean, obviously, we can forgive him for not knowing that in advance. His memory of the actual landings themselves were of these tanks. They were called flail tanks, and they had they were called the Funnies, and they had flails in front, and they would drive up the beach, and they would clear all of the mines to allow soldiers to come up after the infantry to come up behind them and not be in fear of being blown up. But his wife Sheila Dunlop, as she was then, she was in Bletchley Park. So she
Bletchley
Park was where the Codebreakers were. Alan Turing, for example, was in Bletchley Park. And they had
Ross's mummy was in Bletchley Park.
Really? I didn't realise that. Yeah. Okay.
Kate Middleton's mother was her aunt.
Okay, sorry, I'm getting loads of information. It's being information overload
just
here.
Women,
at this
women.
Yeah, no. I mean, this was the fascinating thing was there were so many women at Bletchley Park who were completely ignored. They had the Enigma machine, and they were able to break the German codes. And she knew it was going to happen. She didn't know the date, and she remembers her boss staring gloomily out the window, looking at the awful weather, because the weather was absolutely atrocious in June and July of that year. And she told me also that there was a dance which was due to be held on the eve of D-Day, on the 5th of June, and they weren't sure whether or not they should cancel it, but they decided in the end they better go ahead in case they would tip off the Germans that if they cancelled the dance that there was the big one was coming.
Yeah, there was a very, very funny documentary done about Bletchley, and there was a lot of women there who were very posh and would have been used to staff and all that in their households. And they're usually portrayed as thickos. In fact, they were remarkably un-thicko. But there was a great section where one says to the other, how do you get the tea leaves under the water? They've never made a cup of tea in their lives. But now they were the women, so of course they were making the tea. But anyway.
They knew all about calculus, that's for sure.
Yes.
Another interesting one, and this has I think mainly come to light in the last few years, is the huge and important impact that a humble little weather station in Blacksod Bay played.
Yeah.
This is the story of Blacksod Bay and Ted Sweeney. And Ireland was neutral, but we still supplied weather reports to the UK. So, the work of the Met Office was never ending. And this lighthouse on Blacksod Bay, manned by a man called Ted Sweeney, had a bird's eye view of conditions on the Irish West Coast. And it was his report of diving barometric readings and a 4-6 wind on the 3rd of June that was instrumental in the postponement of the invasion for at least 24 hours. And then on the 4th of June, he filed a report that the heavy rain of the previous day had passed, visibility was clear, and the boffins on the south coast of England who were working on Neptune worked out that, given the wind speeds and so on and so forth, that they would just have a window which would enable them to get the ships over for the 6th of June. Had it not proceeded then, it would have to have been delayed by about 3 weeks because of the moonlight, lunar conditions, and tidal conditions. And had it been delayed until the end of June or beginning of July, it might not even have happened in July, because the weather in July was as bad as the weather in June. It was one of those summers.
There's an interesting documentary. I just saw it in the TV listings next Thursday. A storm front on Mayo. It's about that.
Right.
And Maureen Sweeney, who's 96 years of age. It was on her 21st birthday.
She worked in the post office. She was sending
the readings and all that. So, yeah. So she had a huge hand on the tiller of history.
Yeah. She got two phone calls in the same day from somebody in London, some woman in London, with one of those accents that you were talking about, a terribly cut glass accent. It was, are you absolutely certain of the readings? And she said, yeah, the readings are fine. And then, about an hour later, are you still certain about the readings? And yeah, the readings were fine. I'm sure that's a variation of what you're going to see in the documentary on Thursday.
Right.
No, maybe we're watching, and it's, we should wish her a happy 96th birthday coming up.
Absolutely,
next week.
Yeah.
And then there were others. I mean, one of the most fascinating people I talked to was a guy called David McCaughey. And David McCaughey, who is a Dubliner, and if you've seen Saving Private Ryan, you'll be familiar with some of this, because he was the pilot, they called them, of an LCT, a landing craft tank. And these were the vehicles that were basically dropped down from the ships. The troops got into them, and then these were the things that landed them on the beach, or as close to the beach as possible. Utterly terrifying. And in his case in particular, because he was due to land troops at a beach that was designated as Omaha, and he was landing the American troops. And anybody who knows anything about D-Day will know that this was where they encountered the stiffest resistance. And he got stuck on the beach while all of this maelstrom was going on. And he had a number of abiding memories. One was of the American troops getting out of his landing craft. And he said these were raw troops. These guys had never seen action before. And their immediate instinct was to crowd around the nearest authority figure, who was a sergeant. And what they were supposed to do, they were supposed to, line up, and they were supposed to stretch out along the beach. And there was a very good reason for that. And the reason for that was that if somebody stood on a landmine, he would get killed, and the people on either side of him would get killed. Well, that would be it. But what McCaughey witnessed was the clustering together of these obviously very frightened young men. One of them would stand on a landmine. 20 of them would go up. The other thing he remembers was at the end, when everything had kind of quietened down and calmed down, and they had actually made, and he was still stuck there, and they had actually effected a landing of sorts, was all along the shoreline was helmets with the number 1 in red on the back of the helmets. And this is the big red 1, which is the symbol of the first American infantry division. And there's actually a film called The Big Red One made by Sam Fuller. The other thing which he told me, which was extremely weird, was he was you know, sitting there, wasn't able to move until the tide came and lifted him off. And he saw these strange things, these transparent material blowing around on the beach. And he had no idea what they were. And if you remember the opening sequence of Saving Private Ryan, they get out, they hold the rifles above their heads, they get onto the beach, they take elastic bands off, and they take this strange substance that he had said, it was polythene. And it was to, obviously, to try and insulate the rifles from the water. But they take it off, threw it away, and it was floating all around the beach. And it was, polythene was very new at that stage. He'd never seen it before, and he had no idea what it was.
Interesting, because you, wasn't it you that picked out a story today about how we're one of the worst offenders in the world for those plastics in the water. But anyway, we won't take responsibility for it then. And how did he get away?
He got it. Well, he got the tide. The tide basically lifted him off, and that was when his problems really started, because he is trying to, to get back to his ship. And the first thing is that he's hit with a torpedo. He manages to survive that, and then as he's getting closer to his destination, he's attacked by a very jumpy American ship, which starts shelling him. And then somebody on board decided, okay, well, maybe let's have a look and just see, because that looks like an LCT. The Germans wouldn't have an LCT in the water. So they go and they investigate, and they realise that it's actually, this is a friend, except that he wasn't particularly friendly, because he told me that the language that he used to them, because they had almost killed him, was less than diplomatic and less than complimentary. And, perhaps being Americans and young Americans, they might not even have been familiar with some of the choicest
Irish.
Yes, of abuse. Irish curses.
As somebody that was in the Defence Forces, as you listen to these descriptions,
It's huge. Mustn't forget, it was the largest ever amphibious assault in ever. 150,000 soldiers put across the Channel. A few years earlier, they had Dunkirk, where they had to, rescue them all.
The opposite.
And I was listening this morning, and some of the recordings that Miles mentioned was being played, John Bowman, morning. Mm-hmm. And, it started off with Eisenhower saying his speech to Europe at the time, and de Gaulle was also played this morning, but Eisenhower's speech to Europe was, while we may not have assaulted on your particular stretch of in your country, but the liberation of Europe is nigh, and it's so important. And if I could give a shout out to a book by a colleague of mine, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Harvey, A Bloody Dawn, he details the Irish contribution to D-Day. Mm. And the Irish contribution to D-Day is very hard to quantify, I think Miles tell that, but they say in Second World War, roughly 120,000 Irishmen fought in the Second World War. 70,000 from Southern Ireland, 50,000 from Northern Ireland.
120,000 next of kin addresses. That was the criteria. So 120,000 people gave Irish mammies and daddies as the addresses of their next in kin. And that's just the ones who were actually, who were over and back to Ireland. There would have been obviously many more Irish
born. So while we're not kind of directly involved in this celebration, it is hugely significant in our kind of social history. And in, I suppose going back to Black Sod Bay, our involvement in was the liberation of Europe.
Well,
there was only
one regiment of the British Armed Forces that had two battalions involved, as far as I'm aware, two battalions involved in D-Day on the 6th of June, and that was the Royal Ulster Rifles. One of them went in on the ships, and one of them went in gliders, including, and 30% of the cohort of the Royal Ulster Rifles were from the Republic of Ireland.
And got written out of history afterwards, or got abuse, really.
They did and they didn't. I mean, I think to some, the interesting thing was that what I got from all of them when I talked to them, I kept on saying, you're a neutral. What was it like when you came back? And they said, well, we weren't allowed to wear our uniforms, obviously, and they wouldn't do that. But a couple of them told me that when they would get the ferry back from Dunleary to go back over to the UK, that there were two gangways onto the ferry, and one was civilians and one was forces.
Free travel was a key issue. But I don't think they were ostracised in the same way
as World War One.
In fairness.
Okay, listen, thanks, Miles, for all of that.